Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who has been shipped off from mandatory remedial metaphor training. Joining me today are my usual colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as special guest and first-time roundtabler, Reason's very own, Billy Binion. Everybody say hi.
Howdy.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Peter.
Hello, everyone. Happy Monday. On today's show, we have Christmas with COVID, the last days of Build Back Better, and Elon Musk versus Elizabeth Warren. But before we get to the main events, let's hear from a sponsor. In today's crazy online world, keeping up with the news can be a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that no one should waste time on. Imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, as in positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through the news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with 100-plus news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 premium news for $100 a year. If you go now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/podcast. All right, so let's start with the pandemic. I want to call this segment Bicrom, it's Omicron. Matt's gone, so I can name the segments. The holidays are here.
Can you, though?
Yes, and I just did. The holidays are here, and so is the latest COVID surge. Just about every piece of data points to a significant uptick in the number of COVID cases in the United States and Europe, presumably as a result of the spread of the Omicron variant. Excuse me, Omicron, which appears to be much more transmissible. Both Washington, D.C. and New York City have seen record daily case numbers. Bars I follow on Instagram are voluntarily closing down. People who write for The Atlantic are canceling their birthday parties. Both Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker reportedly tested positive for COVID. We hope they recover fast. Not surprisingly, demand for testing, especially rapid testing, is through the roof, even at $10 or $15 a pop. Those convenient little quick home test packs are selling like they're this year's elf on the shelf. I personally attended a delightful small group gathering this weekend where the hosts required that everyone rapid test before entering their house. I suspect that wasn't an entirely unusual occurrence, at least here in Acela land. So I want to start by going around the panel and asking, what are you doing for the holiday? Are you changing your plans at all because of Omicron? Do you think it's reasonable for people or businesses to make changes to their lives, to their plans, to shut down service or to cancel gatherings? Catherine, let's start with you. I assume you are canceling your gym membership?
Yes, if I had one, I would cancel it. In fact, I may get one just for the joy of canceling it. I am doing basically what I did for Thanksgiving. So in that sense, Omicron has not changed my strategy here, which is that my olds who are New York based prefer that we test. And so we are testing to make the olds feel better. However, I had an extra special dash of like DC government can suck it this morning because I decided that I would use some of these tests that DC hands out at libraries and all over the place. Hey, here's a free COVID test. This is so convenient. It's a free service that is free. You know what happens when government gives away things that are free? There's a long line and they suck. So I did the test this morning. I tried to log into the website to register them. That was a nightmare. And then I got to the testing box and you know what? Bolted shut. Like in a cartoon, like a big bolt is through the door of the testing thing where you're supposed to drop in the tests. Why? Don't know. Government won't tell you. No information. So I'm having extra special COVID-based anti-government rage, which is different only from my normal anti-government rage in that it is COVID-inflected this morning. But I now have to use some of my precious instant tests because, of course, I did buy backups because never trust the government.
Speaking of trusting governments,
the government isn't, I'm sorry, you have to register your tests with the government or is that to get results?
To get results from the freebies. So these are PCR tests, but you have to, you know, drop them in a Dropbox and they test them in the lab and then send you your results. And
isn't that kind of ridiculous though? Because isn't the point that, I mean, at this point we should be testing frequently if you think you have it, if you've been exposed, and that way you know immediately, you know, to stay away from it.
Maybe, but I was like, well, another way of doing testing, if your olds want you to be careful, is to just say, listen, we're going to test a couple days in advance with this higher quality test, send it away, get it back. And that's like a reasonable assurance. Maybe not quite the same as an instant test, but good enough for government work, literally.
Obviously.
Nick, how about you? No more reason happy hours in New York, right? Canceling them all?
You know, we had one last Thursday, and probably over the course of the night, about 100 people showed up. A number of people canceled, citing Omicron, and you know, that's fine. I know we, you know, have an informal check to see if anybody has come down or tested positive since being there. I haven't heard anything about that. But I've been to a number of events, both kind of big. I went to a Atlas Network event last week in Miami, where there were hundreds of people. And there before the big dinner, we were asked to present a to have taken a test to see if we were COVID, had COVID, and if so, stay away. Thank you very much. And that kind of thing has been happening more and more. I've taken, I'd say, in the past 2.5, 3 weeks, I've probably taken 4 or 5 instant tests just to check. Oftentimes at the behest of a host of something. I went to a small dinner on Friday that was people of mixed ages and whatnot, and the hosts asked to both be vaccinated and to take an instant test to see if you were infected. Everybody did that with no, you know, that's what I'm doing. I mean, if people are asking for tests, I will do a quick test, and then, you know, if I'm feeling bad or if I know I've been exposed, I take a quick test, and then we'll act.
How do you feel about bars and restaurants, Nick, shutting down? This just seems to be a phenomenon that's really quite pervasive in New York City, but maybe not anywhere else. I've seen a couple of bars in D.C. do it, but in New York, it seems like all of the fancy schmancy cocktail bars I follow are just saying, we're not going to have service anymore.
Yeah, I think part of it was that as it was coming up into the holiday weekend, you know, or holiday season, which weirdly, most places you would be trying to pack people in. I think there's a real lull in business, and I think they're just getting ahead of it. Obviously, you know, a business has the right to do, to choose whatever they want to do. I think there's most of this is, you know, out of fear. You know, I know it bothers me because I feel like people are acting as if Omicron is, instead of it being perhaps more contagious but less dangerous, it feels like people are acting as if it is more contagious and much more dangerous. And I continue to be frustrated by the fact that we keep talking much, much more about cases rather than the actual, you know, rates of hospitalizations and death and things like that. And also getting people vaccinated, you know, because
I think some of those businesses have made an almost reasonable or, you know, potentially reasonable case that they are trying to protect their staff so that they can be open over the next couple of weeks. But Billy, what about you? You're just going to spend all week critiquing holiday card photos from congressmen, right?
Yes, I'm coming for your guns. But I would appreciate if, you know, in the future, everyone, when taking their holiday photos instead, does so with a handbag, maybe a concealed carry bag.
I look forward to your recommendations.
I'm not ready to be judged for my bag.
I used to be a personal stylist. I'm coming for you.
I can't.
Billy, can they also, does it work well to show the result of your instant test?
That's not my thing, Nick. I'm all in on the handbags. Kate Spade, Longchamp.
Do you think Kate Spade's not rushing to come out with a line where there's a little window that you can slide your little test result in?
You know, if she does.
So it's visible to everyone?
If she does, it'll be on my holiday card photo. If the company
if she does, it'll be a Christmas miracle.
So that's why I corrected
Bill, you travel a lot. This is is that you claim to live in Los Angeles.
No one has any idea where Billy lives.
And,
it's a lie.
And yet every single time we communicate, you're in a different state, sometimes in my own state, and I just don't even know it. It's great to have you.
We don't have
Washington.
A state, Peter.
I'm thinking that maybe COVID isn't the worst thing he's running
from. Are you traveling over this holiday? Does Omicron worry you with travel? This is something that people have said maybe you should be canceling or limiting your travel plans.
No, I'm not changing my plans, and I am traveling. And here's why. Talking about the olds in my family are way more likely than any young person I know to kind of push back on the idea of being cautious. And I know they don't speak for everyone, of course, but I think it's kind of the idea, like, we're going to a birthday dinner for my
clapping for clapping, the olds, right? Is such a mood.
Yeah, the olds work more. The olds push back more. You know what? It's like time for a flabby armed revolution of aging boomers.
Well, I'm talking about like the silent generation or whatever Biden is in. My 88-year-old grandmother, 87, 86, something like that. If she's listening, I'm sorry. But she's having a birthday dinner.
If she's listening, she can't really understand if she's like Biden.
No, she's very sharp.
So it's just like kind of, it's marbles rolling around.
Like that. We're doing a dinner for her on Wednesday. And she was one of the people who was like, of course we're going to still do this. You know, like, not to be morbid, but, you know, I think she sees like time is of the essence and she wants to spend it with her family. I guess the way I look at it is we have a readily available treatment. You can be thrice vaccinated at this point. And I guess I kind of feel like if we start changing plans 2 years into this, we're kind of acting like people don't have agency to take that. I mean, some people will, of course, choose not to. But this treatment, you know, as we've talked about before, almost completely staves off hospitalizations and deaths. And I kind of wish we would stop pretending, you know, as a society, like people don't have agency. I'll also say that one of the more disturbing things to me about this new round of COVID panic is the reintroduction of the, like, if you go to Christmas dinner and unknowingly spread COVID, then you are a murderer or a eugenicist, which is kind of like this blame-heavy argument that is just completely immoral to me. You know, I've thought a lot about, over the course of the pandemic, reactions to the HIV-AIDS crisis and kind of thinking about that in context of COVID. And I really thought that after the AIDS crisis, we'd broadly learned as a society that, you know, people who contract a virus are still deserving of compassion and care, even if you kind of disagree with some of the maybe behavioral choices that led to contracting that virus. And obviously there's a distinction here. You know, in the AIDS crisis, the behaviors in question, not all the time, but the behaviors in question were drug use and sexual activity. And now it feels like the behaviors being demonized are existing, you know, going to dinner, going to a holiday party, seeing your family. And if you don't want to do those things, I think it's totally fine.
You can exist as long as it's only online. Alone.
Right. Well, you know, we do that a lot here. And if you don't want to go to those things, then by all means, I totally respect your right. You know, one of my best friends just uninvited me from her birthday celebration, which was right after Christmas. And I'm like, okay, I totally get that. That's your choice. But I'd also just appreciate, you know, some of that basic respect in reverse, you know, not this reintroduction of, you know, if you choose to spend Christmas with your family, then you're like on the brink of murder. I don't know. I find it completely immoral.
There's also an interesting thing, I think.
Are you, I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask Billy, though, like, so are you, you don't have any animus against, you know, say people like Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker?
That seems like a broad statement.
For catching COVID.
I mean, I have lots of things, like bones to pick with them, but what are we talking about specifically?
Yeah. No, I'm just saying if they test positive for COVID.
Oh, no. Oh, okay. Here's the thing. If one thing stays permanent from this miserable era, it is that when you are sick, you will not go. And I mean, I'm not saying that if you know you have COVID, then go to dinner with your family. I'm just saying if you, as we have seen over the course of this pandemic, a lot of people spread it. Most people spread it, I think, without realizing that they're doing so because the, you know, contagious period starts 72 to 48 hours before you have symptoms. If we can get to a cultural place where, you know, if you're coughing and hacking all over the place, you don't go to the office or you don't go to a party, I'm fine with that.
So it does seem like this could be a game changer in either direction. On the one hand, you know, the increasing cases could just produce some of what we're starting to see already, which is sort of panic, calls for returns to lockdowns. But the other thing that strikes me here is that maybe a sense of inevitability that nearly everyone, including Elizabeth Warren, the world's ultimate Karen follower, right? That eventually everyone is going to get it. And if it's inevitable, then isn't that kind of freeing, Catherine? If that's the case, then why not just get vaccinated, get boosted, protect yourself and your loved ones from severe disease, and then otherwise go on with your life because your behavioral changes are not going to be able to protect you from getting this thing at all?
I don't think that the inevitability element actually affects my thinking a lot. I think the huge difference between now and a year ago is what tools people have to protect themselves. Like, I don't think it's about likelihood of getting it or the fact that you're going to get it, even if you quote unquote do everything right, which I think is a phrase we can now like bury and spit upon its grave. But I think that, you know, the people who are using rhetoric that is basically anybody who is saying stuff like the case counts are higher in demographic or place X than they were at the peak of what, like any formulation like that, even if technically true, seems to me to be fundamentally misleading insofar as it implies that things are worse than they were at that past peak, and they manifestly are not. I, as people who listen to this podcast have kind of gone through an evolution where at some point a few months ago, I really switched to like people have tools to protect themselves and some people are going to make bad choices. And we as a society have to make space for people to make bad choices. I'm like in the defensive driving mode now on COVID. And I think that that is the right mode for us to be as a society. I think we are not there yet, unfortunately.
Nick, so
I would add, just to follow up on that, we're in a manifestly different situation than we were a year ago because people can protect themselves. And this isn't, like I've got mine, so go screw yourself. Vaccines are widely available. They are, incredibly effective. They came online super fast, could have been faster if the government hadn't been so crappy about rolling things out and kind of getting their ass in gear. And right now, you are protected. You can protect yourself. You can lobby your loved ones and the people you care about and your employees to get protected. There are things you can do and you can get boosted. And what bugs me the most about this particularly now is that we are acting as if vaccination and if self-protection plus a bunch of other therapeutics, again, which could be already in place or much, much quicker and moved along if the, FDA was not as bad as it is. That is what's disturbing me. It's like, we're acting as if this is just going to keep going and going. So, Peter, to your question, I would like to think that it, the inevitability or the idea that, we're in the stages of this is how you turn, a pandemic into something that we live with and it becomes endemic and it's not a big deal. There's a lot of resistance to that. And that is exactly the turn that we need to be making, plus jacking up all the innovation that is going to keep making COVID and all of the variants, less and less worrisome to everybody. But I don't get a sense that we're doing that. And that is, deeply, deeply disturbing because this is like COVID without end. Amen. At this
point. A lot of the freakout seems predicated on the idea, the implicit understanding, I think, that actually vaccines don't work. Right. Because if we believed they did work, then in fact, it would seem reasonable to go about doing a lot of the things that you did before COVID existed. But it does seem like some folks, even some Democrats, are actually learning lessons here. Jared Polis, for example, but others in a particularly in education, have been slow to adapt. Anthony Fauci said this last week that he thinks we should mask on airplanes forever. Billy, you fly a lot. That would affect you quite a bit. I wonder, what do you think the very last thing to return to normal will be? Or do you think we will ever return to normal?
Well, I mean, I technically live in LA, a place where you have to be, right, technically, a place where you have to be vaccinated and masked to essentially do anything in public life. I mean, to go into a restaurant, you have to show your little card and you have to have a mask on, which, I mean, to me, I feel like you need to just pick one. Because like you were just saying, I do kind of feel like some of these like tangential measures come across as a little anti-vax. You're saying it's not enough. To your point, I mean, if we'll ever go back to normal, I guess I think the last thing to leave will probably be the masks. I think it will probably take a Republican president to kind of come in and repeal that.
Masks everywhere, or you mean masks on transportation?
Transportation. I think it's actually interesting to remember that a lot of the country is like been moved on. I think about that all the time. Like I was, I'm sorry to the people.
There was an Atlantic story a week or so ago.
That was a great piece from Matt Walter.
A fairly rural area in the country. In which the author wrote about how nobody cares about COVID at all in this
place.
And
he basically said he'd never worn a mask. I mean, like that was a bit much for me. But I mean, speaking of all of my, of being Carmen San Diego or whatever, I was in Florida, like to be a cliche, last December. So a full year ago, and we went to a theme park. I mean, like, this is something that we still were wearing masks and being careful and distancing, whatever. But, like, a lot of people who are not in D.C., L.A., or New York just aren't really thinking about it like this. For the traveling on airplanes, I think it will probably be the last to go is the masks. I will say, though, that, like, if you want to wear a mask on an airplane forever, that's cool. Get your N95 and let me live my life in peace.
So speaking of policy angles and going on with your life, let's check in on Congress in a segment we'll call Baby Got Build Back Better.
No.
Yes.
When is Matt coming back? Is he coming back halfway through this?
So after spending most of this year working on a multi-trillion-dollar spending bill dubbed Build Back Better that was packed with social and climate spending, Democrats appear to have hit a possibly insurmountable impasse in the form of West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who over the weekend went on Fox News, interesting choice there, to say that he'd tried and tried and tried to find some way to agree to a framework for Build Back Better, but unlike the little engine that could, he just couldn't even. "I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation," he told Fox News' Brett Byer. "I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible." I kind of doubt that. "I can't get there." Manchin's concerns reflected a lot of the issues we've talked about on this podcast. Inflation, national debt, the sort of shell games and gimmicks used to artificially bring down the bill's top line cost. And so he said, just flatly, "This is a no on this legislation." Now, I want to leave open the possibility that this might mean a yes on substantially different legislation that still flies under the Build Back Better flag. But it does seem like the Democratic spending bill as we know it is dead. So, Catherine, I want to start with you. I know I said I wanted to talk about Congress here, but I do think this reflects on the executive branch and the person at the top as well. So tell me, how is President Manchin's first year going?
It's going, actually, I guess by my lights, pretty well. No, I mean, I definitely did not have, I probably should have, actually, but I did not have, like, Joe Manchin is the single politician who is doing things that I perceive to be even remotely good in Washington, D.C. on my bingo card for 2021. You know, I think there was a lot of talk about him potentially being, and it was always phrased this way, like the stumbling block, right? And it was like, you know, I guess we've stumbled. Here we are. We are stumble bunnies. But
help, I've fallen and I can't get up.
But I am, you know, I am hesitant to do this thing, which I think I saw most clearly in David Brooks's Twitter feed this weekend, which was he just tweeted, "Did Joe Manchin really just cripple the Biden presidency and make a second Trump term more likely? Really?" That is the wrong way to think about this. That may or may not happen, but that is like, that so fundamentally devalues policy in the face of politics. And I really don't think we should be doing that. This is, as Manchin has very clearly said for months, a huge, massive policy agenda that will reshape our economy and our society in fundamental and difficult to reverse ways where the accounting is pure shenanigans. And he is opposing it on policy grounds. And David Brooks is out here being like, the only thing that matters is whether Team Red or Team Blue wins the White House. And I know there are people who think that way. But, you know, wins the White House for what? Like, what is our goal if not to eventually have, you know, good policy in this country? I will say David Brooks also tweeted that tweet immediately after tweeting a genuinely adorable video, retweeting a genuinely adorable video of a lesbian marriage proposal that occurred like on a softball field in like the cutest little cliched way possible. And I'm like, is David Brooks okay? Like, what's going on with him? I've been wondering that for a while.
As long as it wasn't set at that spa in Los Angeles.
It was adorable.
The spa in Los Angeles?
The Wii Spa?
The one that's constantly being protest over trans people. The Wii Spa?
This was like...
We're just like 10 minutes from my apartment.
The softball player acted like she was injured and her girlfriend came out to help her. And then she was like, psych, it's a proposal. It was adorable. Anyway, I think it is wrong.
I think that's better for a divorce, handing divorce papers, to be quite honest.
Nick, that just shows where you are in your life. And yeah. I'm sorry, my bro. But to see this through the lens of politics, I think is, you know, it is both inevitable in the world that we live in and it is also wrong. If, in fact, Build Back Better does die and Joe Manchin is the person who killed it, then I think we owe him a debt.
So, Nick, speaking of softballs, here's one for you. This seems like a genuinely telling moment for the Biden presidency and for like the state of the current Democratic Party. They waltzed into Washington last year promising a gajillion dollars, I think that was the actual technical number, worth of new federal spending on just about every imaginable Democratic priority that had existed for the last decade or two. And a year later, yes, they passed the relief bill and yes, they passed the infrastructure bill, but most of that looks at least mostly dead in like the Miracle Max sense, right? It might end up being revived here, but it is currently pretty dead on the table.
The chocolate coating makes it go down.
Yeah.
Easier.
So what does this tell you about the state of the Democratic Party and the Biden administration a year after Trump? And what lessons should they be learning from this?
So I think the most important thing is that this is, as much as anything, it's about Biden. And when you look at Biden is posting Trumpian approval and disapproval ratings. He is not a popular president. He has not done well despite, you know, and maybe because he's spending so much money and pushing it. But he is in the beginning of a failed presidency that, you know, that can easily turn around. Ronald Reagan had a terrible, you know, first couple of years and all of that. But what people keep thinking, and this is particularly people in the press, they're like, well, Trump was the absolute worst, so Biden has to be better. In truth of fact, Biden is doing a lot like what Trump did. He's not as in your face, et cetera, but people do not like him. His approval rating right now is 42.7, according to 538. Trump's was 38. They're in the same ballpark. People do not like Biden. And I think a lot of it is for the same reasons they didn't like Trump, you know, which is there's not a strong sense that this is a competent person. This is somebody who is going to be doing a lot of stuff that is kind of disconnected from reality. And the legislation is simply not, you know, it's not that popular. The way that the news, you know, framing this around, oh, it's, you know, it's just Joe Manchin, you know, refusing to go along with the program. Manchin talked about this months ago. He, you know, he said, this is what I need, you know, in order to go along with the Build Back Better plan. This one is much more expensive. So it's actually a failure of leadership on the part of Biden and the Democrats to work out a compromise where they could go forward. Personally, I'm glad about that because we've had at least two full fiscal years of absolutely out of control spending, $6.6 trillion, $6.8 trillion. And I think, you know, what's happening is that people reckon, you know, these are not popular programs. People are starting to get the sense that you can't just keep spending more and more money and expect things to get better. And in fact, you know, inflation is coming back and a variety of other things are not allowing the country to move forward. So I think the framing of this as somehow Joe Manchin is raining on Joe Biden's parade or the Democrats' parade is a way of not dealing with the fact that people are fed up with massive government control, spending, intervention into every aspect of our lives. You know, we've talked about this before. A year ago, 52% of people said they wanted the government to be doing more than it currently was and to do more than what private businesses or individuals could handle. That's flipped and gone back to the normal state of affairs where it's now 54% think the government is doing too much. It would be nice if Congress and particularly the party that runs Congress got that message and started actually kind of thinking and talking and moving forward in accordance with that.
Billy, one of the striking things to me about all this is the mismatch between voter priorities, as seen in surveys, and the Democratic Party's priorities here in Washington. Voters care a lot about inflation, about supply chain issues, the economy, about the pandemic. Yet Democrats have spent the better part of last year obsessing over a zillion-dollar spending bill that includes an Obamacare expansion for the well-off, plans to subsidize union-friendly green energy in ways that might make things even more expensive, even as inflation is already eating into people's paychecks. It sure seems like the current political dynamic just leaves a lot of people politically homeless, right? They're uninterested in Trump's stolen election madness or in Democratic plans to build an even bigger, ever more expensive welfare state. One of those people who you wrote about last week is Kim Kardashian. Yes. So tell us a little bit about that, why it matters. Maybe start with an explainer about who exactly Kim Kardashian is for some of our listeners.
Yo, who doesn't know this?
I think
now?
There are people who are like, I know that Kim Kardashian is a thing, but right. Don't know what that like so, what she is. And maybe my final question on this is, are we all actually Kim Kardashian here?
Oh gosh, I wish. I would describe Kim Kardashian, for those who don't know her, as the original influencer. And by influencer, she has essentially masterfully leveraged every form of media to just kind of like make people love her and advertise things and make things. And she's super entrepreneurial. You know, now she's into criminal justice reform. She's trying to be an attorney and she's a mom of four. And she has a lot of really cute body suits that make women look good, I guess. So anyway, an interview with Barry Weiss, the former New York Times editor turned Substacker, where, you know, as a part of this like lightning round question, Barry asks Kim Kardashian, "Are you a Democrat?" And she just kind of pauses and says, "Yeah, no. Like, I'm a mix of both. I think the Democrats have some stuff figured out. I think the Republicans have other things figured out." And it was interesting because she got kind of like...
And it was Democrats have social issues figured
right,
out
exactly.
and Republicans have
right.
taxes figured out.
She said
out.
Republicans, you know, have the taxes that I like and Democrats have the rights that I like.
Which is an interesting formulation, actually. Like,
it is.
Not that we should be spending a ton of time on detailed exegesis of Kim Kardashian's, like, definition of the word rights, but it's interesting that that's where rights language lives right now.
Right. I mean, she also talked a lot about her criminal justice efforts and how she kind of had to liaise with Trump in that, and how a lot of people kind of assumed that working with Trump meant she endorsed everything he did, which of course it didn't. And it's just kind of another indication of how broken our political and media landscape are. I'm actually really glad you asked this question, though, because whenever the Joe Manchin thing comes up, not to sound like a shill, because I know we're on a libertarian podcast, but the first thing that always honestly does come to mind is the third party argument. You know, there can and should be nuance. Just because he's a Democrat does not mean he's obligated to go along with every single thing the conference wants. But you can see that that's how they think, at least publicly, from their reactions, the White House's reaction, and so on. And I think nothing laid that more bare than Bernie Sanders' comments a few months ago, when he said something to the effect of, two senators cannot be allowed to defeat what 48 senators and 210 House members want. But, like, actually, yes, they can. Because that's the point. You know, it's not just two senators doing that. It's two senators plus the other 50, where there are also fractures in the Republican Party. You know, there's the National Conservatives, there are the Reagan Conservatives. There's like the maybe one or two kind of libertarianish conservatives. But there's this mentality that when you have a senator that kind of, or, you know, or two or three that kind of diverge from your caucus, that they're not allowed to have their own policy goals or agendas outside of what they're told. And that's just categorically false. It's patently absurd.
We also said this in our...
If I may also just mention, Manchin put a price tag that he was willing to pay.
Yeah, you know, he had the document
ago,
that
so
Chuck
it's not
Schumer
like,
signed.
Manchin
right.
is not a small government guy. It's just he you know, he wanted $1 trillion,
sure.
$1.2
I'm not
trillion
implying that Joe Manchin is a libertarian, just for the record.
No, I'm not saying you are. I'm saying this is where the rhetoric is just completely, you know, the, right. the conversation is taking place in a bizarre world where Joe Manchin, by every measure, is a proponent of massive government,
right.
just not this massive. And so he is somehow a problem. I mean, this is absolutely a failure of leadership on the part of Joe Biden, who comes into office with a really slim majority and is incapable of getting stuff, you know, most of the stuff done that he wants. It's not Joe Manchin, it's Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy, though, to think that, like, AOC, Biden, and Manchin are all supposed to, like, want the same things when it's clear that they do not. I mean, that's not how that works. So, like I said, I'm certainly not saying that he needs to, like, lead the charge for a libertarian third party. But, like, I do think that these moments show that there needs to be more nuance. You know, like Bernie Sanders' comment, which is patently ridiculous. I mean, that's just not how a majority works, but... Math is hard. I get that, Bernie.
This is also like always turn to Justin Amash for analysis of congressional dynamics. Like Amash tweeted this weekend that, you know, it's not Manchin's fault that Build Back Better failed, that we have a whole process for debate and amendment and like, you know, crafting a bill that a coalition of senators or congressmen can get behind. And
yeah, I mean, that process is Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and, right. and Biden's chief of staff get together in a room
and, we have chosen,
and they write legislation.
We have chosen not to do that process. And instead, we've done the thing that Peter just described, and it's not working. And we have this other process. We right. used to use it all the time. And this is part of Amash's rage.
So I want to do one more question on this. Nick said a couple times here that Biden is in the middle of a failed presidency. Nick, I want you to contrast that with something that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted over the weekend. So she tweeted, "It is actually delusional to believe Democrats can get reelected without acting on the filibuster and student debt, Biden breaking his Build Back Better promise, letting the child tax credit lapse, no path to citizenship, etc." In some ways, it actually strikes me as kind of true that Democrats are going to have a problem running for re-election on we didn't do any of the things we said we would do. But I also think maybe it's delusional to think that Democrats can get re-elected if they do pass Build Back Better and a bunch of this stuff, nuke the filibuster. And I mean, I just sort of think that barring major upheavals, which, yes, can certainly happen, as the last several years have shown us, Democrats are on a trajectory for some amount, maybe a lot of political loss over the next couple of elections either way. So my question for you, Nick, is there any way for Joe Biden not to have a failed presidency at this point?
Well, to call it a failed presidency, by the way, that's kind of, you know, that's shorthand for saying being a one-termer. Which is kind of, you know, the way that we think about this stuff. We need to also acknowledge how much spending Biden was able to push through already. So he's not going to be a failed president because he doesn't spend, you know, $7 trillion in his next budget year or something like that. But he's failed to deliver on his priorities completely because of a failed leadership. His approval ratings are bad. I don't think his approval ratings are bad because Build Back Better has taken a hike. It's because the way he presents things, the priorities that he's pushed, and a lot of his successes. This is reminding me of when Obama came into office, and Obama had, you know, a good majority in both houses, and he had an agenda. And because of the financial crisis, he had complete run to do whatever he wanted. He got basically what he wanted, and the Democrats started losing in the next midterm elections. I think that's what's going to happen. So I don't necessarily see a failed presidency for Biden as a bad thing, but it's similar to Trump too. Trump came in with a majority and Trump lost it pretty quickly, not because he didn't do enough, but because he actually delivered a lot on what he promised. And this is where, you know, I bring him up a lot, but Morris Fiorina, the Stanford political scientist, has said, you know, that the parties have sorted into conservative and liberal parties. They are run by extreme people in each of those parties. They run and elect candidates who are to the extreme, even of the modal Democrat or Republican, who then get pushed through a lot of an unpopular agenda that is not consensus based. And then they get kicked out every 2, 4, 6 years. This is continuing. And it's partly because, you know, when we're talking about this and we say, you know, Biden needs to get together with Schumer and Pelosi and get all the Democrats to vote along, that is not a model for a long-term consensus or a majority in politics. Like, if the Democrats cannot reach out, you know, when they have a 50-50 split in the Senate and they can't come up with a way of peeling off a couple of Republicans and things like that, and they can do that on certain types of defense.
I mean, the infrastructure bill had, I believe it was 19 Republicans in the Senate vote for it.
So we're not going to get to a place of a stable majority or a stable governing consensus, whatever party that is or what it looks like, until these parties actually start recognizing that, you know, you don't get to do everything you want with 50 votes in the, you know, in the Senate plus one. You have to build a different model of what spending and things are going to look like going forward. And to bring it back to Kim Kardashian, because
always.
I think she, you know, I'm happy to bring it back to her, you know, but what she is articulating when she says the Democrats, she's with them on social issues. I don't think she's not with them in terms of like teaching CRT and, you know, in universal pre-kindergarten. What she's saying is she wants a country where people aren't openly nasty and xenophobic and racist and kind of classist or hateful. And she wants a country with lower taxes, with a functioning economy. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner said exactly the same thing when Trump was running. That's where more people are. And if either of these parties started recognizing that, instead of saying, if you want, you know, marginal tax rates cut, then you have to be a xenophobe. Or if the Democrats say, you know, you have to put up with our vision of America as a failed nation that is steeped in the blood of, you know, exploitation and colonial oppression in order to get, you know, some kind of new spending bill. Those are fundamentally unpopular positions. And we're just going to be ping-ponging back and forth like this for, you know, the indefinite future.
Yeah, I also want to add that one of the biggest pieces of pushback that Kardashian got was this idea that since she's into criminal justice reform but wants lower taxes, that she somehow doesn't care about like reforming the system. I think that to your point, one of the things that I wish we could all learn as a society is that I think most of us really do want similar things, but have very different ideas of how to get there. So the idea that Kim Kardashian, quote unquote, likes lower taxes, I think it's foolish to say that's synonymous with not caring about, quote unquote, economic inequality. So I think part of it is also a messaging issue, right? Like, we just constantly are talking past each other.
Yeah, we don't have a frame, you know, and I'm trying to hold back for the sake of Peter and Catherine to not to say that, you know, what we're looking for is the libertarian moment. It's this is the idea that the government can spend less and be more effective in actually helping people who need help. Like, you know, we need a functioning economy that is stripped of all really stupid regulations, including high taxes, including high regulations that keeps it from growing and innovating. And we want the government to spend less, but kind of do it better. You know, school choice is a great example. And I guarantee you, you know, that the Kardashians are all in favor of allowing people to go to the schools that they want and helping them, you know, helping to fund that, but not go to, you know, the terrible schools that they personally avoided when living in places like Brentwood.
So it sounds like we should ditch President Manchin for President Kardashian, or maybe we should move on to a new president named Elon Musk. But before that, let's go to a sponsor. We all want to make sure our family is protected in a medical emergency. What many of us don't realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full amount of an emergency medical flight. Even with comprehensive coverage, you could get hit with high deductibles and copays. That's why an AirMed Care Network, that's the AMCN Network membership, is so important. As a member, if an emergency arises, you won't see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Best of all, a membership covers your entire household for as little as $85 a year. AMCN providers are called upon to transport more than 100,000 patients a year. This is coverage no family should be without. Now, as a listener of our show, you'll get up to a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card with a new membership. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use offer code REASON. Okay, so this week's listener question comes from listener Adam. He starts, "Hello, Roundtablers." He has a theory, maybe even a conspiracy theory, that Elon Musk is gearing up to run for president in the 2024 election cycle. Musk has relocated to Texas out of California, has increased his Twitter bashing of progressive politicians. Okay, so he sounds like a Reason staffer. His outspoken criticisms of the government dysfunction, overregulation, debt burdens, monopoly on violence, et cetera, his comments on the Great Resignation seem to indicate to this listener that he is positioning himself to run on the Republican ticket in 2024. Of course, that is speculation. Yes, it very much is speculation, but it raises a relevant question. Would anyone on the roundtable consider voting for Elon if he were to run for president as a Republican in 2024? So I actually have a query for this listener's question, and that's whether Musk would even be eligible to run for president, given that he was born in South Africa. But I would urge you all, as you answer this question, to reflect on it, not just as a yes or no about whether you would vote for Musk, but as a question about the role of zillionaire, entrepreneur, outsider, provocateur types in politics. Catherine, I want to start with you because you have strong feelings about both rockets and voting. What say you? Would you vote for President SpaceX?
I would not vote for Elon Musk for president. Two reasons. One, I don't vote. I still don't vote. Even if Elon Musk ran, I wouldn't vote. I don't vote. Second, though, because I think that it would be not a good use of Elon Musk's time to be president. I think that one reason it looks like maybe he's positioning himself to run for president is because Elon Musk is so much more capable than normal mortals that he can do basically three things at once. Here's what he did just his last few days of tweets tell me that here's what he did. First of all, he did two rocket launches. The Falcon 9 launched twice in 15 hours. He built the company that did them. He's highly involved with that company. Like, he did two whole ass rocket launches. Also, absolutely owned Elizabeth Warren on Twitter. I mean, just crushed her under his Twitter boot in a way that obviously was very appealing to me. This is building on, as the letter writer notes, several tweets, stuff like him saying that government is the biggest corporation with monopoly on violence, where you have no recourse, which I love to hear. also tweeting that if the temporary provisions in Build Back Better become permanent, the national debt will increase by 24%, and nothing is more permanent than a temporary government program. His whole Twitter feed is full of these like kind of cliches that are also like somehow when Elon tweets them, just like take on new meaning. And he apparently recorded an episode of Hardcore History. Like, he's just out here doing a thing that would be my best week every week. And so I think like he's casually doing politics better than many politicians, which is why you might look at our garbage slate of available Republican nominees and be like, that guy doesn't look bad. I think we have learned in Donald Trump that being a prominent businessman does not necessarily mean you will be a good president. I will not rule on whether being a good businessman changes the equation. But Elon Musk is clearly so valuable in the private sector. He's doing so many important things, including doing things to generate enough value to pay $11 billion in taxes this year. It's very hard for me to imagine that even the most effective President Musk would do more for this country than just him out there being Elon Musk in the private sector.
I'm always impressed that he's managed to launch these companies while also having time to play clearly an awful lot of video games, including the games that I play that take hundreds and hundreds of hours to complete, and somehow he has. Billy, we just had a billionaire rich guy as president, as Catherine said. Donald Trump was many things, including a kind of Hollywood elite famous from a TV show, but he wasn't part of the Washington Beltway cocktail party machine. So first of all, how did that work out? But also contrast that with the guy who we have in the White House right now, Joe Biden, who is the ultimate political insider, who has spent his entire life in Congress in Washington, just sort of doing political business. Doesn't it seem like in some ways both of these models have problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just kind of speaks to the necessity of having a congressional body that aren't performers. I mean, like the thing that strikes me most about, I mean, and I say that because obviously the president has power, but Congress should be doing, I don't want to say they should be doing more, but they have more agency to do more than they're doing now, or it just seems like they stall and don't do anything at all. I mean, like, for instance, watching criminal justice reform die after like record momentum. I think the thing that struck me most about this Liz Warren versus Elon Musk back and forth was, you know, Catherine mentions that Elon Musk will be owing taxes this year. But we're still doing this bit where we act like these people don't pay any taxes. Like, I don't know if you guys remember during the 2020 election cycle back in 2019, which feels like 15 years ago, Joe Biden kept going back and forth with Amazon saying like, you know, they don't pay any taxes. They need to pay more taxes than a teacher. Keep in mind, they pay billions in, you know, state and international levies. And the only reason they're able to do federal tax write-offs is because of a tax code that was written in part by people like Joe Biden to incentivize things like research and development, innovation, and creating jobs. And so, you know, I say all of this because I feel like Liz Warren, for all of her policy wonkiness, is still just another performer. And I think, you know, we have a lot of performers, both at the executive and in Congress. I think that, you know, Congress is where it's really at, though, if we want to see change.
Nick, Catherine and Billy already mentioned Musk's Twitter spat with Massachusetts Senator, current COVID haver Elizabeth Warren. Last week, after Time magazine named Musk Person of the Year, Warren tweeted, "Let's change the rigged tax code so the person of the year will actually pay taxes." That's a quote. "Actually pay taxes and stop freeloading off of everyone else." Musk returned fire with, "If you opened your eyes for 2 seconds, you would realize I will pay more taxes than any American in history this year." Followed up this morning, noting he would pay $11 billion in taxes, which really seems like a lot. So, Nick, doesn't this speak to a fundamental and maybe one could even say intentional misunderstanding on the part of Democrats who have spent the last year arguing that America could have all the social and climate spending they wanted if only gazillionaires like Musk would just pay their fair share? What's that Warren line? Like her wealth tax, it's just 2 cents. It's just 2 cents, Nick. Why won't Elon Musk pay his 2 cents and fund Build Back Better?
Yeah, you know, it's, and we've done, you know, we did a video about this. If you took all of the U.S. billionaire wealth and confiscated it completely in one fell swoop at full market value, you know, at listed value, it would fund all government spending in America, including state and local and federal government, for about 6 months. You know, this is, you know, to the extent that you're talking about whether or not billionaires like Elon Musk are paying enough taxes, you are trying to misdirect people from the fact that we just spend too much money, you know, across the board on everything, if that's what we're worried about. And we should also note that the fact the government is not constrained by the amount of money it collects in terms of how much it spends. We're, you know, we're basically borrowing 50% of virtually every dollar that we spend on things. So that's not the issue. I find the gesture to reach for a businessman to take over, and you know, this happened with people like Wendell Willkie in the past. Obviously, Donald Trump did it, Ross Perot in the past. This is also part of an impulse on Republicans who have nobody that they think is worth really kind of running. They the Republican Party, in a way that the Democratic Party does not, always floats with bizarre, weird, you know, candidates like Herman Cain, right? Herman Cain was going to save us, you know, a decade ago or something like that. So as much as it's pathetic on the, it shows how bad Democrats are, it also shows that Republicans really have a lack of imagination and generally speaking tend not to be that serious about governance. To the extent that we're talking about who's going to be running against Biden, you know, there's a bunch of Republican governors who seem to be lining up, Ron DeSantis first and foremost. But I go back to what Catherine said, you know, Elon Musk's comparative advantage, and this is apart from the fact whether or not he's even legal to run for governor, but it's, you know, his comparative advantage is doing a lot of stuff that's really kind of interesting and innovating while also getting a lot of subsidies. I mean, that's the thing where, you know, Elizabeth Warren is so lame that she doesn't even point out, as recent has, the billions and billions of dollars that Musk has got, you know, gathered through various kinds of state and federal subsidies. These are kind of false arguments to my mind. I mean, what we need is a government that is serious and it does fewer things and does them better. But nobody really wants to talk about that because that would actually require, you know, some kind of focus on things that people actually need.
Right. And people also don't want to talk about the fact that, to your point, there aren't enough billionaires to fund the government, which would mean you would need like heavily tax the middle class, which is not a popular thing to say.
Which is what Europe does. I mean, through a variety.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, people are always pointing to, you know, I guess Norway and Denmark, where they have like very low corporate taxes. I think they're around what the US's are now after they were cut like 13%. But it's not popular to say that, which is why we have these like theatrical spats with people saying that Amazon and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, quote unquote, don't pay taxes.
Not to mention the slipperiness between personal income tax and corporate tax, which inevitably people who are making this argument will forget that distinction. Like, what Elon Musk's labors have put into the coffers of the federal government by, you know, three or four different definitions ranges from many, 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 many billions to zero. And people are just using whichever number they want to make their point. Yeah.
Right.
Trump didn't help this conversation either by, you know, hiding his taxes, which I don't care about. But,
conversation.
You know, the fact and that could have been a great teachable moment. This is, you know, of the many things that Trump was very disappointing on, I think one was, he was in a position to say, hey, here is what I paid in taxes, and I didn't cheat. I used every, you know, every line in the tax code to pay as little as possible. And that's one of the reasons why we need to redo taxes so that they are fair, flatter, and transparent.
Right, right.
So everybody's paying.
Yeah, something. And the reason I mentioned the corporate tax with the distinction that Catherine just made is that the senators are always pointing to these parts of the world that are these, you know, quote unquote, democratic socialist havens. But even they understand that corporations need to have fairly low corporate taxes because of all the things they incentivize. These are real things, jobs, research and development, innovation that societies benefit from.
Okay.
Can I also just to extend this painfully a little bit further, but
like a spider's web, would you say? Like a shot
yes,
from the
well,
wrist.
I know we're
going to
be hearing about spider's web. So, you know, Musk and Warren do represent different visions of kind of the world. And, you know, and without going into details too much, but the great thing about Elon Musk, and I think this is legitimately fantastic, is that he is pointed towards the future. You know, and you can make fun of him and you can say he's, you know, he gets all this government money and he's a weird guy and he has a terrible, you know, personal life, all of this kind of stuff. But he is fundamentally a man who thinks that the world is going to get better by innovating and changing things and kind of dreaming of big projects and then working towards them that will radically transform how we do everything. Elizabeth Warren is not that type of person. She is trying to hold on. I mean, she, in her own way, when she wrote books like The Two Income Trap, she is trying to hold on to the world in which she was raised and thinks, oh, the good parts are worth saving and we are going to lock down all kinds of innovation, all kinds of change. She doesn't want the employer-employee contract to move from what she perceives was its platonic form, you know, working in big corporations in mid-century America. She wants, families to be able to have one bread earner and get by, et cetera. I mean, it's a fundamentally backward-looking model, and she is threatened by every development that changes the rosy-colored version of the world that she thinks she grew up in and needs to be replaced. And in that sense, they're natural enemies, and it's kind of good if they're going to go at it, because I think that's it really clarifies for a lot of people, okay, do you want to live in Elizabeth Warren's world, which will never change ultimately, and everything that you do will be, you will have somebody kind of sniffing around and checking and double checking your math, and you got to go get that in triplicate from up in, you know, HQ on the 80th floor of a skyscraper, or you have people like Elon Musk who are like, whatever else you can say about him, he is absolutely building the future, and to date has already delivered more stuff that is really fascinating and cool, and that's going to make everybody's life better. So
I wouldn't vote for Musk, but I do think Elon Musk in the White House would be kind of funny. And that's more than I can say for our last few presidents. Since I am talking about entertainment value, let's move on to our end of show cultural recommendations. I will take moderator's prerogative here and go first. Like just about everyone else in the country, it seems, I saw the new Spider-Man movie, Spider-Man No Way Home. It's pretty good, but it's also just a hall of spider mirrors. It's like the two Spider-Men's meme in $200 million movie form. And it's a kind of weirdly telling moment about the state of the Hollywood franchise blockbuster, which has become incredibly complex, but also incredibly insular at the same time. It's just not about anything except itself. This is literally a Spider-Man franchise sequel about how you have loved Spider-Man franchise sequels for the last 20 years. And in that respect, sure, it's true. I've loved them. I love Spider-Man, but it is kind of weird. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I, in all honesty, have been consuming the rest of some things that I was consuming in past weeks, including finishing up a big old chunk of 70 over 70, which I recommended previously. But I did do this thing, which people who live with them, I guess. When that person reads a book, sometimes you sort of read the book too. And my husband has been reading This Is Your Mind on Plants by Michael Pollan, which we've talked about on this pod before. And so I have not been reading it, but I have been knowing what's in it in that osmosis-y way that sometimes happens in households. And it's an interesting book. The thing that I actually have been thinking about, though, is how Michael Pollan just has a big thesis and then just gives you 1 million examples of why his thesis is true, each with a really nice anecdote in the kind of theory of like throw the spaghetti at the wall and one of these examples might convince you the thesis is true. Here you go.
This strongly appeals to your sensibility as an editor, doesn't it?
It does. I have some thoughts about this as a mode of argumentation and I kind of like it. But I, you know, I think that many Reason staffers will be joining Nick Gillespie on his psychedelic journey sooner rather than later. And that this book is should probably be required reading for the staff. We're just going to be like, from now on, it's, you know, Road to Serfdom. And if not this book, some other book about psychedelics.
What's the big lesson? Like, if it's a big thesis, give me the one sentence.
The big lesson is I think probably it's the metaphor, because it's always a metaphor that, you know, your brain is like a sledding hill, and that people tend to sled down the paths that already exist on the hill, and those paths get carved deeper and deeper, and that taking psychedelics is like new fallen snow on your brain. The paths are erased, and that you can choose or try out different paths, and that might be good for an awful lot of people.
So it's the book equivalent of the kicker final line in the Wesley Snipes Blade film. After he kills the bad guy, he says, some mother effers always trying to ice skate uphill. And it's the greatest Wesley Snipes line in the history of great Wesley Snipes lines. Billy.
you know, the Passenger 57 fan on this,
no,
on this
podcast it's better
is going to disagree.
So I'm going to take this question literally. I have been consuming Applebee's.
Ugh, why?
Why? So right. Caitlin Flanagan.
You're
from
looking good in the neighborhood.
Yes,
aren't you?
Yes, queen. So Caitlin Flanagan, right at the Atlantic, said something over the weekend like, you know, I don't like Applebee's, but I like potato skins. Is there a place for me in the culture war? And I responded with the truth, which is that anyone who says they don't like Applebee's is lying. And I believe that. And it inspired a trip. Last night, I tried to get both Catherine and Peter to join, and they respectfully declined. Respectfully declined. I got some spinach and artichoke dip that looked like nuclear waste. I got chicken wings that were not chicken wings. They were chicken tenders disguised as chicken wings. It was way too hot.
Were they boneless chicken wings?
They were, but they were chicken tenders that they probably heated up in the microwave. It was way too hot. Like, there's something with the heat that was weird. The like light above the table was way too bright and kind of felt like I was in a police interrogation. But if you like moved an inch over, you were like completely shrouded in darkness. But it was like a taste of America. It was like a taste of my childhood. And I, with this review, fully urge every listener to go get some Applebee's.
I was raised on Chili's like a good American, and so
Chili's
I reject your
Chili's
Applebee's nostalgia.
One of my favorite pieces of gonzo journalism of the last like 20 years was when a Gawker writer went to test the limits of TGI Friday's endless appetizers and right. like see how much she could consume. And I've always actually wanted to know how many mozzarella sticks I could consume in a day because I don't think that the number exists.
Right. Like, yeah, I got mac and cheese with some chicken on top, and it was kind of bland, so I ordered some sour cream with it.
Oh.
That was where we were
wrong
at.
With you?
That is real America.
Okay, honestly, didn't we also have like a Cheesecake Factory based insurrection this week?
I do love Cheesecake Factory. Honestly, Cheesecake Factory stresses me out though, because their menu is literally like 25 pages.
Yeah.
So there are too many choices. I'm very indecisive. But honestly, Applebee's will always win because they have the Dollarita. It's a dollar margarita. A happy hour. Get thee to an Applebee's.
Did you get some sour cream to just put on top of that too?
I didn't get a Dollarita. I don't think they were on the evening menu. But I fully enjoyed everything else.
My opinion about cocktails, as always, is that people should drink the thing that they like and shouldn't be judged for it. And I think I may have to make an exception. Nick, what have you been watching?
I watched the finale to Succession, or you know, and the final.
So this was a week ago,
third
right?
Season. Yeah, but I had other things that I was consuming that were more pressing, and I liked, you know, I liked going back and looking at a couple of other parts of the episode of this season of Succession. What I find most interesting about it is there are two things. One is that generally, it is a show about media and business, you know, about, you know, high stakes business, where it seems pretty clear to me nobody there knows what they're talking about. And so they create this kind of phony, authentic sounding jargon and argo in order to talk about stuff, which I find funny. I know a lot of people think the show is well written. I think it is abysmally written, but that it's incredibly well acted. And which brings me to what I enjoy about it, which is that it's, you know, it's King Lear without a Cordelia. There's no rooting interest. There is no moral center. And in that, I think it's, you know, it's a wonderful addition, ongoing addition to the kind of universe, broadly speaking, that HBO introduced with shows like The Sopranos, where, you know, if 21st century television, like, you know, quality TV, status TV, has a dominant tone, it's that we live in a universe where there is only kind of darkness and there is only a kind of Nietzschean impulse. And it leaves the viewer in a place where you need to land on people to kind of root for or admire, but you know that at any given moment they're going to do something reprehensible or you're going to hate them. And then it becomes, you know, that's kind of the point of the show. And so I thought it was pretty good. And I, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how this stuff plays out.
Nick, where are you in the Jeremy Strong discourse?
You know, I read the New Yorker article about him, which did not seem to be particularly offensive, although a number of his former co-stars came to his defense. You know, I don't think he is that absorbing a figure, to be quite honest. So
Yeah, it's a really, really good show. I've really enjoyed watching it, maybe even more as the show has progressed, in part because it's about the media, but it's not just a Veep-like satire of a Fox News empire. It's also, I think, interestingly, for sort of our reasony worldview and interests, it's a portrait of generational warfare between a completely callous and awful elder sort of statesperson monarch, right? The Logan Roy, who owns the company and is, you know, on his way out at some point, but refuses to ever actually leave. And then a new generation of failed and feckless elites in the form of his children, all of whom are just desperate, absolutely desperate to avoid responsibility for anything or to ever do anything that might risk their privilege. And so in that way, it's not just about the media and about, you know, Fox News or whatever. It's also about the kind of precarious state of American leadership and the problems we have both with the current iteration and the people who would aspire to be the next set of leaders. Okay.
And then it leads to the, you know, to the what happens at the end. And this is not a, or in this season is not a, spoiler, although it's over, so we shouldn't be worried about spoilers, but you have the next gen of kind of tech and media, the movement into, you know, whether it's social media or other formats, that is leaving cable news and even regular TV behind. So, you know, that's an interesting setup. And I think in the next season, that'll be the most interesting thing to see if the, you know, if the depiction of where things are going in terms of media and media consumption, and is the platform more important than the content, and is the content still relevant? That could be an interesting, you know, that could be interesting. And I agree, Peter, what is most curious about it as an allegory is that all of the Roy children, none of them are actually hardworking or particularly competent, but they feel extremely entitled to inherit everything and to have the world still respect them in a way. And that's kind of a dark, you know, it's very potent, but it's also a dark vision of where we are, I think, as a country.
On that note, that is it for this week. Thanks everyone for listening. Matt Welch will be back from Simile Boot Camp next week. Hopefully he is not drowning in a mountain of mixed metaphors.
Wow.
Bye, folks. Have a good one.